Good day. Today is Tuesday, 14th July, 2026. It is, in fact, Bastille Day, the National Day of France. May I first take this opportunity to congratulate all French people on this important holiday. One other person is today celebrating Bastille Day, and as it happens, he is doing it in France. And that is Ukraine's president, Vladimir Zelensky. Yesterday, reports started to circulate about how Zelensky had again left Kiev. Then pictures appeared, film appeared of his airplane arriving in France and of him being received at the airport by various French dignitaries. And of course, he attended a coalition of the willing in France, co-chaired by Emmanuel Macron and the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who is incidentally in his very last days in office. His successor, putative successor, Andy Burnham, has now been overwhelmingly supported by the British parliamentary Labour Party as the next leader of the party. Burnham is likely to become Labour leader in a formal capacity on Friday, and it is expected that Starmer himself will resign on Monday as Prime Minister, so that by the end of Monday, Andy Burnham will have replaced him as Prime Minister of Britain. Nobody, by the way, should expect any change in British foreign policy as a result of these various changes. Anyway, Britain and France, Macron and Starmer, as I said, chaired this meeting of the so-called coalition of the willing in Paris. And Zelensky, of course, was there. And of course, he demanded money and he demanded endless, extraordinary supplies of Patriot missile interceptors. Apparently, he asked for 100 Patriot missile interceptors a month, which, if true, would be more in a year than the United States actually manufactures in any one year. Anyway, Zelensky asked for more Patriot missile interceptors, and he asked for more money, and he received promises of more money. And he also, by the way, appears to have secured a promise from Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, who, as of this time next year, will no longer be president of France. Zelensky received a promise of Rafale fighter jets from France to be delivered by 2028, which looks to me, by the way, an impossible deadline. Western aircraft, up to now, it must be said, have not performed well against the Russian Air Force in the skies over Ukraine, despite many predictions that they would. I suspect that by 2028, assuming the war in Ukraine is still ongoing, the balance of forces in the air will have shifted even further in Russian favour. And of course, by that point, the Russians will also be fielding larger numbers of fifth generation fighter jets, the Sukhoi 57, which is now being equipped with a new engine. And anyway, I don't expect these Rafale fighter jets and the Gripen fighter jets that the Swedes recently promised to Zelensky to make any difference in the war in the sky. That certainly is my view. Anyway, never mind. Zelensky was in France. A Ukrainian military contingent, relatively small, but anyway, they were there. They participated in the Bastille Day parade, a way, if you like, for the French government, for Macron, to make known his ardent support for Ukraine and France's ardent support for Ukraine. I would expect in times like this, by the way, that seeing a military contingent from Ukraine participate in a military parade of this kind in France would be France in effect signalling that it treats Ukraine as a military ally, which is strange because, of course, the French government officially continues to insist that this is not the case. Anyway, I'm not going to delve into the various contradictions or the various promises of help that Zelensky is getting and whether these promises have any realistic prospect of being fulfilled or anything of that sort in this programme, not at least in any detail. For the record, I believe that it is far too late now in this conflict for this kind of military aid, for these sort of promises to make anything like the difference that they once did. Zelensky has come to Paris, and obviously one of his purposes was to attend the meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, of which, by the way, there have been many over the last year and a half, ever since Starmer and Macron came up with this dreadful idea, initially of deploying peacekeeping forces to Ukraine. There have been endless numbers of meetings discussing this idea, purportedly coming up with plans for it, debating the numbers of French and British and other troops who would be sent to Ukraine. There's been endless numbers of these meetings. Macron and Starmer must have got to know each other extremely well over the course of these many meetings. But not a single one, not one of these meetings has made any actual difference. There's not been the ceasefire that the Europeans endlessly insist on and which Zelensky endlessly insists on. There's not been any sign of the Russian army being stopped in its tracks. There's been no sign that the Russians are modifying their policy with respect to Ukraine at all. The United States, as I've said many times, in most respects has distanced itself from this affair, except that it continues to conduct a spectacular but militarily ineffectual drone offensive against Russia, about which I will have a lot more to say later. Anyway, these coalitions of the willing, as I said, they provide Zelensky with an excuse to leave Kiev, but that's practically all in practical terms that they really do. And coming to that point, one senses that Zelensky, who now spends a great deal of his time abroad, I haven't added up the days, but I'm going to guess that he spends roughly a quarter to a third of any one year outside Ukraine now. And my sense is that the proportion of the time that he's spending outside Ukraine is steadily increasing. Anyway, it's not perhaps as if Zelensky needs these excuses to go on his travels, but he has a particular reason to go on his travels now. Because, of course, just before he left Ukraine, he carried out a massive governmental reshuffle. Now, there's been no real explanation of why this reshuffle was needed at this time. The Ukrainian Prime Minister, Mrs. Sidorenko, has only been in post for a relatively short time, a few months, if I remember correctly. As far as I'm aware, there are not any significant complaints about the way in which she has managed things in Ukraine, though given the realities of the war, given the essential collapse of the functioning part of Ukraine's economy, superbly charted by my friend Ian Proud in various pieces that he's done on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, and in his videos on his YouTube channel. Well, it's absolutely clear to me exactly what role the Prime Minister of Ukraine fills at this particular time. Interestingly and curiously, even as Zelensky has sacked Sidorenko and is spreading stories, and stories are being spread in Kiev, that Sidorenko is going to be sent to Washington to act as Ukraine's ambassador there. Again, no real explanation of why she needs to replace the current Ukrainian ambassador in Washington. But anyway, even as Sidorenko has been sacked, there is no word as to who exactly is going to replace her. And, well, there's a very interesting article, again, on the indispensable Substack site, Events in Ukraine, which suggests that one possible candidate for the job of Prime Minister is Mikhail Fedorov, who is currently Ukraine's defense minister. He too, by the way, has not been that long in the post. He gets lots of very golden opinions in the West and on the part of some people, perhaps the more Western aligned people in Kiev, in the media there, as the man who is the architect of the drone war against Russia. But it seems that Fedorov is not particularly liked by the Ukrainian military. According to Events in Ukraine, Sirsky, the armed forces commander, dislikes him, and there is significant hostility between them. And it also seems as if Zelensky himself is uncomfortable by some of the praise from the West and from Western-aligned people in Ukraine that Fedorov has been getting, and is starting to see him as a potential rival. So anyway, there is some speculation that Fedorov will be taken away from the defense ministry and kicked upstairs and be appointed to the post of prime minister. Now, I am not somebody who is very interested in the games of musical chairs that we see the political system in Kiev go through on a relatively regular basis. But I would make two observations. It is strange for Zelensky to announce a major reshuffle in his government and then leave it unfinished in Kiev and fly to Paris without having placed people, the new people he wants to appoint, to the positions that he wants them to hold. You would expect that he would complete the reshuffle before he went on this trip to Paris. And to my mind, the fact that Zelensky has left the reshuffle substantially incomplete suggests that this is another measure by Zelensky reflecting the increasing nervousness and panic that is starting to take hold in Kiev. You would, as I said, expect in other circumstances things to have been done in a more orderly more less chaotic way, even if one allows that Zelensky himself does have a tend to do things very chaotically. So anyway, an incomplete, unfinished reshuffle with the boss leaving Kiev with nobody really in charge, because that's what we basically have, spending at least 2 days, from what I can tell, in France, even as there's nobody properly speaking in full charge and with full authority back home in Ukraine, even as the war in Ukraine continues. So that's one thing that has happened. Now, there may be some reasons for there may be a specific reason for this panic, which goes beyond the deteriorating problems on the battlefronts, because, as has been discussed now by many people, by myself on this channel, but by many other people too, it does seem as if Ukraine is indeed facing an increasingly severe manpower crisis. The army, by many accounts, is finding it more and more difficult to fill the gaps in the front lines. I read accounts both by the Russian newspaper Redovka and by the Russian journalist Marat Khairulin about how the Russians have been able to infiltrate positions at various points on the front lines because Ukraine's shortage of infantry is opening gaps and spaces which the Russians can infiltrate and fill. So one effect of this is that the conscription process in Ukraine has been getting tougher and tougher. It has already been marked by great levels of violence for at least 2 years. There is profuse footage of Ukrainian recruitment officers seizing people off the streets, bundling them on buses, taking them to the training centres where they get trained and then thrown into the front line. And this has been now a regular film footage for quite a long time. And there's also been regular film footage of incidents involving other Ukrainian civilians who have entered into confrontations with these recruitment officers in various Ukrainian cities. There have been violent confrontations between recruitment officers and Ukrainian civilians. And anyway, this has been a steadily intensifying process across Ukraine. But what seems to have particularly alarmed the Ukrainian leadership is that a few days ago, this pattern of seizing people off the streets and that provoking a protest from the local people spread to the western city of Lvov in western Ukraine, in some ways the heartland of Ukrainian nationalism, what has been described as the most patriotic city in Ukraine. Now, I am not sure that this was in fact the first protest against conscription in Lvov, but it does seem to have been substantially the biggest and in some respects the most violent. And there is extensive full film footage of it, which you can see in events in Ukraine. And this footage shows how many people, the large number of people who were involved, and the extent of the confrontation. And events in Ukraine has also provided information about the crackdown that took place after this protest by the authorities. It It provides photos of some of the ringleaders of the protest who have now been arrested, some of whom definitely look as if they received at least some ill treatment following their arrests or perhaps during their arrests. And anyway, the incident altogether appears to have triggered alarm, sufficient alarm, amongst the political and military leadership in Ukraine, that Zelensky's chief of staff, Kirill Budanov, Ukraine's former military intelligence chief, was forced to come out and give a television interview about it, in which he criticized the protesters involved and said that if you want to avoid even worse violence from the Russians, then you need to support your army, and that must extend, presumably, to supporting the violence of the recruiters. It's a strange argument that in order to prevent worse violence against yourself, you must somehow tolerate a certain degree of violence against yourself. But that basically seemed to me to be the argument that Kirill Budanov was making to the people of Lvov. Well, I don't want to give the impression that Lvov is in a state of insurrection. I don't think that nowhere in Ukraine is that true. There is a rather painful article, at least I found it painful to read, article in Larry Johnson's indispensable Substack site, Sonar 21, from somebody who's just been to Ukraine and has just visited Kiev. The picture that this person draws is of a very bleak situation indeed, of a demoralized and frightened population, deeply unhappy and longing for the war to end, but incapable of offering organized resistance to a relatively small group of people who wield a tight control over the system of government, the system of power in Ukraine itself. Now, I have not been to Ukraine. I cannot verify the picture that this person draws of the situation there. It may be that there is still more support for the government and for Zelensky than this article suggests. But for the record, I do get the impression of great war weariness and frustration and indeed fear in Ukraine, and an increasing unwillingness maybe to fight and a longing for a return of peace, which at the moment is impossible. Now, this sense that the mood in Ukraine is not good may partly explain the reshuffle. I suspect an even bigger reason is indeed the situation in the war. And I'm going to suggest here that the war in the sky is in fact even more than the war in the ground, where the greatest alarm in Ukraine within the leadership exists, even and despite the way that Ukraine has been talking up its own drone offensive against Russia. One of the primary purposes of the drone offensive against Russia is to draw attention away, obviously, from the deteriorating situation for Ukraine on the ground, but also from the growing difficulties that Ukraine itself is facing in the sky. Now, yesterday, I discussed in my program how Ukraine's air defences seem to have collapsed, how Ukraine doesn't seem to be able to organise air defences any longer. There's no longer Patriot missile interceptors, though the effectiveness of those is open to some challenge, especially by Professor Theodore Postol, who knows about such things. But anyway, the fact is that Vladimir Putin, as I discussed in my program yesterday, said that every time Ukraine attacks Russia with drones, the Russians will make a symmetrical response, and with every Ukrainian attack, the Russian counterattacks, counterstrikes from the sky will become ever more powerful. And I also said in my program yesterday that, in my opinion, and contrary to what Putin is suggesting, the Russian strikes follow a pre-prepared plan, one that was probably worked out some time ago. They're not, in other words, just retaliatory strikes. And Putin's comment about the strikes becoming ever more powerful, to my mind, clearly points to the use of the Oreshnik system at some point in the war, probably at some point over the next few months. And, well, there's been lots of commentary about Ukrainian drone strikes, but Putin said that the Russian drone and missile strikes are far more powerful. And that indeed is what they are. Now let's first of all discuss Ukrainian drone strikes. The Ukrainians last night attempted another major drone strike against Moscow. The drone strike seems to have been unsuccessful. The Russians, by their own accounts, which there is no reason, as far as I can see, to deny, managed to shoot down either all or practically all of the hundreds of drones that the Ukrainians sent towards Moscow. The Russians, over the last couple of days, have been increasingly talking about how their counterintelligence service, the FSB, has been arresting people around Russia and seizing stockpiles of drones smuggled into the country, into Russia, by Ukraine and intended by the Ukrainians to be used to attack facilities inside Russia. So about a couple of days ago, the Russians spoke about how they'd thwarted a Ukrainian attack on an airfield in Rostov. The Ukrainian agent, or the person that the Ukrainians tried to recruit into this to carry out this operation, to prepare the drones, the Ukrainian drones, for an attack, supposedly contacted the Russian authorities and guided the Russian authorities to where the drones were. And, well, the Russians are providing much less information, relatively little information about this incident. I made it clear that, in my opinion, the person who supposedly contacted the Russian authorities and gave the game away was probably an agent of the Russian security services all along. Anyway, that's my view. After that, the Russians reported how similar operations that the Ukrainians intended to carry out against various other facilities across Russia had also been detected and thwarted. And yesterday, the Russians spoke about yet a further incident where this had happened, where people had been arrested, where drones had been seized. They published video footage showing crates of Ukrainian drones in some sort of warehouse in Russia, apparently being prepared to strike at a Russian drone factory. And, well, the cumulative impression is of a very complex operation by the Ukrainians to get large numbers of drones into Russia to conduct strikes against targets inside Russia, and of the Russian security services penetrating and breaking the networks and being able to thwart these operations. Now, all of this reinforces my own view, which I've held for some time, that many of the drone strikes on targets in Russia, on refineries, on the Omsk refinery, for example, that took place some days ago, against other facilities in Russia, which have been presented as being the result of long-range drone strikes conducted from within the territory of Ukraine, have in fact been no such thing. They have instead been the product of operations similar in some respects to Operation Spider's Web, the operation the Ukrainians carried out last year when they attacked Russian strategic forces, air bases across Russia, striking various Russian strategic bombers, or trying to. And of course, those strikes were carried out by sabotage teams using drones that Ukrainian intelligence had infiltrated into Russia. And, well, that was how those attacks were carried out. And a significant, perhaps important part of the Ukrainian drone offensive of the last few weeks that we have been hearing so much about, it's starting to look to me as if it too was conducted in a similar way. So the result is that as these networks are being broken up by Russian counterintelligence, and that's certainly the impression that I'm getting, the Ukrainians, in order to sustain their drone war against Russia, are now indeed having to launch their drones from very long distances, from within Ukraine itself. The drones are relatively small. They carry a relatively small explosive warhead. The fact that they have to travel over these very long distances make it easier, much easier, for the Russians to track and detect them. And by the time they approach Moscow and other major facilities or cities deep inside Russia, they have been mostly already intercepted and shot down. We've seen over the last few weeks a significant decline in the effectiveness of Ukraine's long-range strikes against Russia. And I'm going to suggest that this is probably at least one of the reasons that some of these strikes were not long-range strikes in the first place, but were carried out from within Russian territory. And the Russians have now penetrated the networks that were doing this, these things. Anyway, that's one part of Ukraine's drone offensive. The Ukrainians have also, of course, been conducting drone strikes against Zaporozhye and Kherson region and against Crimea. They continue to do so. They conducted another drone strike against Sevastopol in Crimea last night. Sevastopol was for a time without electricity or at least parts of the city were. But overall, again, I'm getting the sense that the effectiveness of these drone attacks has been declining over the last 2 weeks. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the Ukrainians then redirected their drone strikes towards the Sea of Azov, where they started to attack Russian commercial ships in the Sea of Azov. And all across the media in the West, there have been all kinds of claims about how the Ukrainians have managed to strike and destroy scores of ships in the Sea of Azov, something which, as I said, if you know anything at all about ships, and you know anything at all about drones, you would realise is inherently very unlikely. Damage may have been done, but it would be very difficult for drones to be able to sink large container ships and freight ships and certainly tankers. And anyway, the Ukrainians have been striking at these ships, and no doubt some have been severely damaged. Maybe a few have been so damaged that they have been effectively destroyed or even sunk. I don't have the full details. But I doubt that the damage has been as extensive as some people, both in Ukraine and in the West, have believed. Anyway, the Russians have not said very much about these attacks on the Sea of Azov until today, but today they have in fact done so. And the Russians have provided the following discussion of the situation in the Sea of Azov. And I'm taking it from a piece that has been published by the Russian news agency TASS. Anyway, this says that the Russian Transport Ministry is taking measures to maintain cargo logistics amid increasingly frequent attacks on civilian vessels in the Sea of Azov. The Russian Agriculture Ministry, for its part, stressed that the situation would not affect domestic food supplies or the country's export capacity. The Transport Ministry says that ship owners are working on measures to protect the fleet, whilst port captains are seeking to improve traffic management and reduce vessel handling times. If necessary, and depending on the operational situation, bulk cargoes will be redirected to other modes of transport in connection with other relevant government agencies and industry associations. The situation in the Sea of Azov will not affect food supplies on the domestic market or Russia's export capacity. Given the substantial agricultural cargo handling capacity available in various regions of the country, supply logistics would be rerouted if necessary. Alternative cargo routes are currently being developed jointly with relevant government agencies and businesses. Russia will fulfill and fully honour its obligations to foreign partners regarding grain supplies, despite the situation in the Sea of Azov, and this has been said by the Grain Exporters and Producers Association. And the union noted that the industry's developed infrastructure has significant reserve handling capacity to quickly redirect grain volumes to other terminals. So this is the report from TASS. Now, that report appears to contradict claims in Reuters that appeared in Reuters that the Russians have closed the Sea of Azov to shipping. And by the way, last night the Ukrainians released film footage of more drone attacks on ships in the Sea of Azov, though some have noticed a reduction in the number of ships that the Ukrainians appear to be hitting. But, well, it looks as if maritime traffic is still passing through the Sea of Azov. A reasonable guess is that ships are being provided with crews, trained crews, with surface-to-air missile, with man pads and perhaps cannon to shoot down drones, and probably other precautions, of which I'm not going to try and make guesses, are also taking place. But clearly there is a problem in the Sea of Azov, but we can see the Russians themselves in this article which came out today, making the same point that I made in my programme yesterday, that Russia has lots of alternative maritime routes it can use. It can redirect traffic to other ports. For the Russians, what happens in the Sea of Azov is not an existential issue. So if it's food cargoes that are being shipped to foreign customers through the Sea of Azov, which this article implies is what the Ukrainians have indeed been attacking, the Russians say that they have alternative routes and will fulfill all their export obligations. And about that, I have no doubt that is correct. There may be delays. It may be that some ships carrying cargoes will arrive late at their destinations. But the Russian export trade in grain is not going to be affected. And of course, the domestic food situation in Russia is not going to be affected either. It cannot be, given that Russia is itself self-sufficient in most types of food. So anyway, that's the situation with the Sea of Azov. Now, by contrast, the Russians continue to conduct their own strikes against Ukraine, and they do so every day. They carried out more strikes last night using Iskander missiles on Kiev and KH-59 subsonic cruise missiles launched by tactical fighter jets Sukhoi 34s. The Iskander missiles, which the Ukrainians, for some unknown reason, always refer to as S-400s. S-400s are, of course, surface-to-air missiles. They are not ballistic missiles used in these sort of attacks. Anyway, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, the Russians attacked again industrial facilities in Ukraine. This now is the regular pattern. The Russians do this pretty much every day, and they do this at night. They do it at night and at day as well. And mostly, from what I can tell, it's, as I said, military industrial facilities that the Russians attack. So the very latest reports from the Russians speak about attacks, for example, on more factories and plants in the Kiev region, which are involved in military industrial manufacturing. But the Russians, even as the Ukrainians conduct strikes against ships, commercial ships, in the Sea of Azov, the Russians have been hammering Odessa and the port of Odessa. For example, the Russian Defense Ministry has just published this report. It says that during the day, and that day, by the way, is today, the Russian military continued to launch strikes at ports of Ukraine and vessels involved in the interests of the armed forces of Ukraine. An interesting form of words, ships involved in the interests of the armed forces of Ukraine. Notice that the Russians no longer claim that these ships are necessarily transporting weapons. They just say that these ships are operating in the Ukrainian military's interests, which really doesn't tell us anything. Anyway, the dispatch from the Russian Defense Ministry continues. Drones hit two dry cargo ships on their way from the port of Chernomorsk of Odessa region to the port of Odessa. In the port of Yuzhny, air-based high-precision weapons were engaged. Infrastructure facilities of the MiGTRANS logistics center, lorries and petrol tank lorries, 12 lorries and a petrol tank lorry transporting military cargo and oil for the armed forces of Ukraine were also attacked. So the Russians are busy attacking Ukrainian ports, and of course the ports that they're attacking are all part of the port complex of Odessa. And it was the Russians aren't just attacking the port of Odessa and ships that tried to either leave or dock in Odessa. The Russians are also, and have been busy for some time, attacking the various transport and supply roads to Odessa. Now, the point is that as the Russian Transport and Agriculture Ministries and the Grain Producers Union are saying, Mariupol, the main port on the Sea of Azov, is only one Russian port amongst many. Odessa is essentially Ukraine's only port. These attacks on Odessa are having probably, in fact undoubtedly, a far bigger impact on Ukraine's ability to import goods and to export goods than the attacks that we are seeing the Ukrainians carry out in the Sea of Azov. And this is a growing problem for Ukraine, which of course runs a major deficit, current account deficit. It imports far more than it exports, and it depends on imports to maintain even a semblance of normal life inside Ukraine. And of course, the Russians are not only attacking the ports, but as I've discussed in several programs, they have been attacking the railway system, primarily in eastern Ukraine. They've been attacking trains, and they've been hunting and destroying locomotives. And that, of course, is also critical for Ukraine, because most of the goods that get transported to Ukraine, those which do not go by sea, must come by land, overwhelmingly through rail. And though the Russians are not yet attacking rail terminals and junctions in western Ukraine, the destruction of locomotives, which are impossible for the West to replace because Ukrainian locomotives are built to handle a wider gauge or gauge than you will find used in Western railway systems. The attacks on the locomotives are going to eventually have an impact on Ukraine's ability to move its trains. Now, the other thing, of course, is the gradual and remorseless expansion westwards of the tactical attacks by the Russian drones. Russian Garand drones can reach anywhere in western Ukraine and have regularly done so. However, these are Garand 2 drones that follow pre-programmed flight paths. The Russians earlier this year experimented with tactical drones. We are still talking about Garand drones, but Garand drones that were controlled from Russia by ground controllers in Russia, which were able to loiter and conduct tactical strikes in western Ukraine, and did so using signals, sending signals via the Starlink system, upon which the Russians were piggybacking. And this created, as I remember, a wave of alarm in Ukraine and complaints to Elon Musk. And Elon Musk immediately acted and he recalibrated the Starlink terminals in Ukraine, but not those in Russia, which made it impossible for the Russians to continue to conduct drone strikes in western Ukraine using the Starlink system. But, as I have recently pointed out, the Russians have recently taken to conducting strikes using Garand 4 optically guided drones, not just against gas filling stations in eastern Ukraine, which they have been doing, but they have now started to use these jet-powered, optically guided Garand 4 drones, which are must also be controlled by controllers in Russia. They're starting to use them increasingly in central and to some extent in western Ukraine as well. And, well, there's lots of speculation as to how exactly this has been done, whether they're using the relay stations in Belarus, whether they're using some other guidance system, like the mesh guidance system that the Russians have been working on, whereby drones send signals between each other. I think the simplest explanation is that these drones are now getting signals from Russia's analog to Starlink, which is the RASVET system. And we're starting to see attacks being conducted in central and western central Ukraine in that way. Now, if I am right, then it is only a question of time before the Russians start to conduct tactical drone strikes against gas filling stations and such facilities in central and western Ukraine too. So, put it all together, and the war in the sky continues to get worse for Ukraine. And all of this, even as there are more rumours today of another mass strike by the Russians, principally on Kiev, with missiles and drones. Some reports speak of as many as 2,000 Garand drones being used in the next big strike. Previously, in earlier iterations of the war in the sky, the Russians, because the missiles they used had to follow pre-arranged courses, focused on attacking large facilities like power stations, big railway junctions, barracks, those kind of things. No doubt we will get many more of those over the next few months. But alongside what you might call the strategic aviation attacks. You're also now starting to get tactical strikes. And these appear to be spreading across the whole of Ukraine. Tactical strikes against much smaller, but nonetheless vital facilities like gas filling stations, smaller warehouses, perhaps also, before long, electricity transformers. There was an article in the Financial Times saying that there is, in fact, a shortage of supply in the West of these as well, and that it's proving impossible even for the United States to upgrade its own electricity system rapidly enough to meet the demands of AI data centers because of the worldwide shortage of transformers. Anyway, the Russians could start attacking these. These are relatively small targets. And drones, Geran drones, would be the obvious weapon to use against these targets too. And as I said, all the indications are that this is now steadily spreading across the whole territory of Ukraine. So probably Zelensky and his officials know about and understand this. And they know that for all the appearance of a success in the war in the sky, it is Ukraine that is suffering the existential blows. A strategic offensive by the Russians, which was already devastating, is now being complemented by what you might call a tactical offensive, attacking smaller but critical targets like locomotives as well as transformers, gas filling stations. The kind of air operation that Western air forces regularly conduct against countries that the Western powers attack once the Western powers have achieved air supremacy, which, by the way, they nearly always up to now have been managed, able to do. Anyway, all of this is also happening alongside the situation on the ground. I'm not going to discuss this in great detail today, but there have been more advances in Kharkiv and Sumy region by the Russians. Radovka yesterday claimed that the Russians now control a third of the village of Beli, or rather the small town of Beli Kolodis in Kharkiv region. So it looks as if that town is also soon going to fall. There's said to be very heavy fighting going on in the area to the east of Slavyansk for the village of Nikolaevka and for the Slavyansk thermal power plant. And the Ukrainians apparently are struggling to retain control of these. And the Russians continue their advances in Dobropilia and apparently from Konstantinovka towards Druzhivka, and all of these things continue to play out on the battlefronts as well. So the situation on the ground continues to deteriorate. It looks increasingly as if Donbass will indeed be lost, and relatively soon. So anyway, the battle for Ukraine is getting more and more difficult. And if you add to that the internal difficulties within Ukraine, of which perhaps this protest or riot, if you prefer to use that word, involve is a manifestation. You can understand why Zelensky is becoming nervous, why he is trying to recalibrate the government structure in some way. Though clearly he still hasn't thought through exactly what he plans to achieve by it. Because if he had, he would presumably have replaced all of the people whom he has just sacked. Anyway, that's what I will say today about the situation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the other war, the war between the United States and Iran, continues to escalate. Donald Trump, the President of the United States, has now informed Congress that the situation is once again one of effective war between the United States and Iran. In other words, the ceasefire is over. The memorandum of understanding is now dead. And, well, anybody who has been observing the strikes and counter-strikes that have been taking place can see this for themselves. I mean, any suggestion that we are still in any kind of ceasefire situation in the Persian Gulf is now, well, it's clearly absurd. Now, President Trump, as he so often does, has been talking grandly about how the United States is going to take control of the Strait of Hormuz, how it is going to impose its own toll on the Strait of Hormuz, going to levy 20% fees on the value of ships or cargoes, apparently, which is, by the way, as I understand it, more than the Iranians are saying they're going to charge. Anyway, President Trump has been talking in this way. In my experience, he tends to do this when he feels himself to be under pressure. The Iranians, for their part, have been conducting missile strikes against tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. My understanding is that shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has completely stopped. The United States is now in the process of reimposing its sea blockade on Iran. And predictably, as a result of all of these things, oil prices are once again rising. If this continues for many more days, and it's difficult to see why it would not, then eventually we will probably see oil prices, headline oil prices, again at $100 a barrel, with worries that the already depleted oil reserves can only hold out for so long. Anyway, listening to Donald Trump and reading the various things that he has been writing, it's fairly obvious to me that he has no plan as to how to deal with this situation. He doesn't have any actual plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, if he had one, through military means. He would presumably have done it before, and that he's basically thrashing around, saying one thing after another, in the hope, probably forlorn, that something will come up. Now, my own experience of negotiations is that if two parties who are in conflict come to an agreement with each other, like the memorandum of understanding, and then after just 2 weeks that agreement falls apart, which is what we have just seen, then trust between the two parties is even worse, or mistrust between the two parties is even worse than it was before, in which case moving towards a renewed agreement, a new agreement, is even more difficult. Now, maybe that is not a hard and fast rule, but, well, I don't see any reason why it should not be the case in this particular situation. In which case, this conflict that we are in has every prospect of going on right through the summer into the autumn, with the Iranians now already reverting to their position, that the position that they had in March, which is that they will not agree again to an interim ceasefire or to a memorandum of understanding of the kind that we have just seen. They want categorical cast iron guarantees from the United States that this time, next time, it will fulfill its obligations. And that means that they're reverting basically to their original position, the one they had at the beginning of March, which is that there will be no interim agreements, only a final agreement whereby the United States lifts sanctions, repays all of the frozen assets to Iran, removes its bases from the Middle East, or at least from the Persian Gulf area, and stops insisting on any limits on Iran's nuclear enrichment program. In which case, as I said, this conflict will go on right through the summer. Oil prices will continue to rise. The situation with the reserve, the oil reserve, will become worse. The situation with the American inventories of weapons will become worse. We will probably see a vertiginous rise in oil prices, probably at some point in late August, and come the autumn, we will have severe economic problems in Europe and in North America as prices rise, energy prices rise to the dizzying levels that we are likely to see. Now, just after he signed the Memorandum of Understanding, President Trump said that the reason he had signed it was because there were only about 4 weeks left of usable oil in the reserves, and that he did not want to be President Herbert Hoover, whose policies brought about the Great Depression. What exactly has made him, over the last few weeks, move from that entirely rational position to the bizarre position that he has at the moment, where he has essentially trapped himself and the United States and most of the world in an open-ended confrontation with Iran, which will bring about precisely that economic crisis that he warned about? I don't know. Perhaps he still believes that he can bring the Iranians to their heel, the energy blockade, the oil blockade that he's going to try to impose on Iran will somehow do that. He didn't do this before. Why he assumes it will do so now, I have no idea. I saw, by the way, a report in on the Interfax news agency that Russia and Iran are now finalising an agreement for Russia to supply Iran with natural gas. I'm not sure whether there are any pipelines linking Russia and Iran. I doubt that there are. And of course, if we're talking about supplies of liquefied natural gas, well, yes, they can presumably reach Iran across the Caspian Sea, just to say. But the supplies would have to first be transported from the Arctic to the Caspian seaports, to Astrakhan and those places in Russia, presumably by rail, be a complex and expensive undertaking, and one perhaps vulnerable to attack by the Israelis or the Americans. But anyway, perhaps it can be done. Perhaps there's other ways of doing it. Perhaps the Russians can supply natural gas to Azerbaijan, which could then transfer it to Iran. Or perhaps they can do it through some kind of reverse flow mechanism through Turkmenistan. I don't know. But I do wonder whether perhaps over the next few weeks and months, we're going to see more of what we saw back in March, with more economic assistance being provided to Iran, first and foremost by the Russians, and perhaps by the Chinese too, which, if it happens, will of course negate any calculations that Iran can be forced into submission through oil blockades of the kind that the United States is now reimposing. I would add that the American attack on the bridge, on the bridge inside Iran, the railway bridge which links Iran to China, the railway line that links Iran to China, almost certainly has not been well received in Beijing. The Chinese probably are not happy with some of Iran's actions, but as Donald Trump's visit to China back in March also showed, the Chinese are in absolutely no mood to pull coals out of the fire for the United States, certainly not in relation to Iran. So, well, again, I don't understand the American strategy. It seems to me that the United States has got itself again trapped into an open-ended conflict with the Iranians that can only have negative results for itself and for the collective West and for much of the rest of the world. And one of the parties which obviously is going to suffer worse and most from all of this is Ukraine. When the memorandum of understanding was agreed a few 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was lots of commentary in the media in the West that one of the big beneficiaries from the memorandum of understanding would be Ukraine. It would release American resources to support Ukraine again. And we did, in fact, have various comments either made by President Trump or attributed to President Trump about how supportive of Ukraine he had again become. Well, obviously, those resources, those American resources, have not been released again. It doesn't seem very likely that Ukraine is going to get any Patriot missiles at all, or indeed all sorts of other weapons, air-to-air missiles, cruise missiles, the new types of cruise missiles, the dirty dagger missiles, and those sort of things. I suspect that whatever America is producing will, over the next few weeks and months, go to re-equip the United States. I said earlier in this program that Zelensky's sudden reshuffle might be a sign of growing alarm and panic. When you put all the facts together, you can start to see why. And well, I said that I couldn't understand why sending Sidorenko, the current prime minister, to Washington as the new ambassador, what good that would do. Well, perhaps Zelensky thinks that sending her to Washington might achieve some kind of magic there, might get the Americans thinking once again about Ukraine, even as they have this deepening crisis over Iran. Anyway, there it is. That's the situation between the United States and Iran at the moment. And it also tells us the effect that this is all going to have on Ukraine. But bad as this crisis is, something has now happened which might potentially make it worse still. Because an Iranian aircraft flew to the capital of Yemen, Sana'a. Sana'a, I should say, is controlled by the Houthi movement. And there is some question as to what the purpose of this aircraft was. The likeliest explanation is that it was returning to Yemen, the Houthi delegation which attended the funeral of the late murdered supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Anyway, the Saudis warned Iran and Yemen that this aircraft, this Iranian aircraft, should not fly to Yemen. And they bombed Sana'a Airport when the Iranians insisted that the flight would proceed. It seems that the aircraft was diverted to another airfield in Yemen, and whoever was on the plane was able to disembark, and that the plane returned to Iran. But of course, this incident has outraged the Houthis and made them very angry, and there is now apparently word that the Houthis are now again thinking of closing the so-called Gate of Tears, the exit point through the Red Sea, which remains the only access point that the Saudis have for their oil. Now, there's been a lot of discussion as to why the Saudis took this extraordinary step, which was apparently cleared by President Trump and authorized by him. In fact, it's not difficult to speculate as to the reasons. The Saudis have always been deeply alarmed by the possibility of Iran and the Houthis forging an even tighter alliance. And they've historically always objected to the establishment of an air bridge between Iran and Yemen. The Saudis probably see that as an existential danger to themselves. And, well, MBS, the crown prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, is known sometimes to allow his emotions to guide his actions. And I suspect he was absolutely furious when he heard about this flight and was alarmed about the possibility that an air bridge might be re-established. And he felt the need, therefore, to take this extremely fierce action to basically cut off that possibility. However, decisions taken in anger are often repented at leisure. And I wonder whether this one will be, because the Houthis do undoubtedly have the capability to close the Gate of Tears, in other words, to close the Red Sea to maritime traffic. They showed that they have that ability to do this in 2024 and 2025. President Trump and Pete Hegseth deployed a significant part of the US fleet trying to force the Gate of Tears reopened again. They failed, something which ought to have acted as a warning, by the way, against starting any sort of operation against Iran. What the US was unable to do in 2025. It's difficult to see how we can do in 2026. We don't yet know what the Houthis are going to do, whether they're going to close the Gate of Tears, strike at the Saudi pipelines. There are already reports that they have launched missile strikes inside Saudi Arabia itself, though the Saudis are saying that they've managed to shoot down all of the Houthi missiles, which may or may not be true. I've no way of knowing. But anyway, if things between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, between the Houthis and the Saudis, escalate, if we get ourselves into a situation of all-out war between the Houthis and the Yemenis, and if the Gate of Tears as a result is indeed closed, well, $200 a barrel oil, I guess, becomes a real possibility. We seem to be, again, drifting back into an extraordinary crisis in the Middle East. I am baffled that this has been allowed to happen, that so little has been learned from the experiences of March and April. It seems, again, that there is a fundamental inability in the United States, in Israel, among some people in Europe, to learn the obvious lessons. And, well, we are where we are. Personally, I don't find it difficult to understand why Vladimir Zelensky is becoming nervous and is again staying away from Kiev and is becoming worried about the situation in Kiev itself. My friend Ian Proud, in a superb article that he has published on his Substack site, speculates that in 2027, Zelensky might finally be ousted from power in Kiev as the situation in Ukraine continues to get worse and as it becomes increasingly obvious to everybody that without him gone, there can be no peace in Ukraine. Well, I don't want to make those predictions, but I can certainly imagine that Zelensky himself is nervous about these possibilities. And anyway, we shall have to wait and see what happens over the next few weeks, both in the Middle East and in Ukraine. But my sense is that we are now definitely on the slide. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. You can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop. Please remember to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this video. And, well, I'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, have a very good day.